is Robert M. Saunders speaking. The purpose of this tape is to provide some information about the accreditation of engineering programs in the United States and your role in that process should you be called upon to participate. In this tape, I shall provide some history and background of the accreditation process, tell a little about the organizational structure of the Engineers Council for Professional Development, talk about the accreditation cycle, and talk a little about your obligations as an IEEE visitor to the profession and to the IEEE. You should have before you at this time a pamphlet entitled IEEE Orientation for Accreditation. These are the visuals to accompany this audio tape. This work is extremely important to the IEEE and the profession and the nation. The quality of our technology is only as good as the people supporting it, and the vitality of the profession is completely dependent upon the quality of the people in it. In no small way, this quality is due to the education of the engineer. The Engineers Council for Professional Development is the organization that assures the profession that a graduate meets the minimum standards of the profession. The Engineers Council for Professional Development, ECPD, was founded around 1932 to assure the profession that the minimum quality of a curricula was such that government, industry, and private practitioners could be sure that the man they hired had a minimum educational experience that would equip him to practice engineering. This particular organization developed because there were many schools at that time turning out people who were labeled as engineers whose quality of education was sufficiently low or questionable that they could not be trusted with the public safety. As it developed over the years, the ECPD became a strong force in the development of engineering education in this country, and it had a profound influence on the quality of the education that engineers receive. There are counterpart agencies in this country and abroad that also contribute to the assurance of the quality of an engineer who graduates from a baccalaureate or an advanced program. First of all, there are regional associations. The regional association accredits a whole institution. It makes sure that the institution meets some minimum criteria as far as all of the fields that it engages in. The regional association makes sure that the mathematics, the humanities, the social sciences are up to a certain set of minimum standards. They're more concerned with library resources. They're more concerned with space and balance of program than they are with the details of a professional program. For that reason, it's necessary in some cases for the professions to have their own accreditation process. The professions such as medicine, architecture, law, and engineering are a few of those who have their own accreditation process, and these are termed professional accreditation agencies. As I say, the agency for the accreditation of engineering education in this country is the Engineers Council for Professional Development, or the ECPD. Now, the ECPD does some other things other than be involved in the accreditation process. It is true that this is its principal and largest function, but it also carries out a program of guidance of pre-college students, and also carries out a program concerning the development of the young engineer. In other words, it does these things in connection with other engineering societies. In reality, the ECPD is a federation of engineering societies. It has no individual members. Its members are all other engineering societies. So it is a group of then of societies that are banded together in a common cause, be it accreditation, pre-college guidance, student development, young engineer development, or ethics. In this presentation, I'm going to set aside for the moment all of the functions except the accreditation. This is not because they're unimportant, but because we are focusing in this particular at this particular time on the accreditation function. The organization chart for ECPD is the first figure in the folder on IEEE orientation for accreditation. You'll note that there is a board of directors consisting of three members from each of the participating societies. There is a current change in the constitution being put up for endorsement by the society, so this may change shortly. However, the board of directors are sent to the ECPD by the participating societies. They, in turn, elect a president and a vice president, a secretary, and a treasurer. There is also an executive secretary who serves the function of carrying out the directives and policies of the board, the president, and so forth. There are then committees established to carry out the functions of ECPD. There's a committee on ethics, a committee on the development of the young engineer, a guidance committee, and a student development committee. There are two accreditation committees, one in engineering technology that's concerned with the baccalaureate program in engineering technology, and that involving the two-year technician training. The second of these committees, and the one that this particular tape is directed toward, is the Engineering Education Accreditation Committee, who are concerned with the baccalaureate engineering degrees and the advanced degrees, which are generally at the master's level. This committee is made up of 24 people who are selected to represent the particular society such as the IEEE. The IEEE has two representatives on this committee. The officers of the committee are not representing the societies once they have been selected as officers, but they are all selected from membership on the committee or past membership. The committee is organized with a chairman who is elected for 1 year. There are two vice chairmen, one for operations and one for policy. This is a ladder organization. One starts out as vice chairman for accreditation, advances to vice chairman for policy, and then becomes the chairman. The past chairman is retained for one additional year after he serves to provide continuity. The committee has a secretary in ECPD headquarters who works full-time for the committee. The secretary's responsibility is to make sure that all the books are kept, that all the documents are flowing in the proper fashion, and that everything runs smoothly. The committees are organized around certain regions of the country. Generally speaking, these regions are structured in such a way that there are almost an equal number of schools in each region, and yet they follow state boundaries. There's a regional chairman and a vice chairman. And the regional chairman and vice chairman, there are eight regions in all, have responsibility for certain activities within their region. For example, each year they must canvass the schools to find out what changes have occurred during the ensuing year. There are also some members at large that do not have regions. Generally speaking, these members at large represent those societies that do not have curricular responsibility. To become a regional chairman or vice chairman, one must represent a society that has at least 15 curricula accredited at the present time. So that, very briefly, is the organizational structure. I will say that it's a very effective organization, and it comes about in for really two reasons from my observation. Number one, every member of the committee regards his activity as being extremely important to the profession. In other words, they are an extremely dedicated group of people. They work hard. Each one contributes upwards of a man-month a year to the accreditation process. They serve for relatively long periods of time, 5 years. It's true they're only selected and appointed annually, but they are eligible for 5 consecutive terms. The board of directors, on the other hand, turn over much more rapidly. They are dependent on several factors within their own organizations, and there's less continuity at the board level. So the real continuity and the seat of continuing excellence rests in the accreditation committees. Now I'd like to turn to the functioning of the E&A committee in somewhat more detail. In your orientation for accreditation folder, you have a document that represents an excerpt from the annual report of the ECPD. This is entitled Accredited Curricula Leading to the First Degrees in Engineering in the United States. And this starts out with objectives and procedures. This is the really basic written material that is public material that available to all people. If you do not have a copy of the annual report of ECPD, I suggest you write to ECPD headquarters and obtain one. In the normal course of affairs, you will get one as a member of an ad hoc visiting team list. But if you don't have one, you should ask that you be provided with it. In this particular report, the other information that's present there has to do with the functioning of the remaining committees, the constitution, the overall rules of procedure for the organization, something about the Engineering Technology Committee, and a list of potential visitors for ad hoc accreditation teams. Now, the E&A committee, then, has to do with the issue of evaluating and identifying curricula that meet the minimum standards of the engineering profession. They do so only if the school invites them to come, and the ECPD will only come upon invitation issued by the school. The ECPD identifies then to the public and its prospective students that constitute the public those educational institutions that meet the minimum criteria. You've heard me use the word minimum criteria many times, and please remember that in the accreditation process, it's only dealing with the threshold. It's not dealing with evaluation or relative worth, but only with meeting a threshold. In modern parlance, it's much like a pass-not-pass grade in a course as opposed to a graded course A to F. There's nothing in the accreditation action that's taken that represents anything other than a threshold. Now, there are two sets of criteria for a program to become accredited. The so-called quantitative criteria and the qualitative criteria. And over on the second page of the excerpt on accredited curricula leading to the first degrees in engineering, you'll notice the section entitled criteria. And it points out several factors that are quantitative in nature. There are 9 of them there. The most important of these having to do then with the content of the curriculum. The matter of the organization of the institution, the age, and the number of students enrolled, and so forth, all are contributory to the accreditation process. But from the point of view of the ad hoc visitor, the most important aspect is that of the engineering curriculum. And I'd like to focus your attention on that aspect for a bit. You'll note that it says that an engineering curriculum acceptable to ECPD normally, and I emphasize the word normally, will be characterized by A, the equivalent of approximately 2.5 years devoted to mathematics, the basic sciences, the engineering sciences, and the integration of these into a meaningful educational experience directed toward the development of the ability to apply pertinent knowledge to the identification and solution of practical engineering problems. It further goes on and says that this 2.5 years must include at least 1/2 academic year of mathematics beyond trigonometry, at least 1/2 academic year of basic sciences, and the equivalent of 1 academic year of engineering sciences. If you do your arithmetic on that, you'll notice that there's a 1/2 year left out, which has to do then with this integration of these into a meaningful educational experience. And the ECPD does not spell out how this integration shall be performed. The basic sciences are considered to be physics, chemistry, and biology, and in some cases the earth sciences. The basic sciences then are those that establish the fundamental background on which an engineering education is erected. The mathematics is specified to be that beyond trigonometry. And this means that the courses in the mathematics ought to begin with analytic geometry and calculus. The ECPD also requires that engineers have an exposure to the subjects in the humanities, social sciences, and fine arts, and requires that there be a 1/2 year in those areas. If you add up the total number of years required, it comes to a total of 3. So that leaves 1 year then for the school and a normal 4-year program to put in there anything that it so desires. There are some general restrictions on what they can put in and in a program. For example, if they put in a combined program in engineering and business administration, the general view that the ECPD would take would be that this is a dual-purpose program and that the engineering content has to be examined in terms of the adequacy of its experience in the total frame of reference of the program. And in many cases, it will suggest that it should be an extended program and operate over, say, a 5-year period of time instead of 4. But in general, you'll be visiting schools in which there's a clean-cut 4-year program in the sense that there are a certain number of units required for graduation in 4 years, and you judge then the programs based on these criteria. In the following the section on accredited curricula in your folder, you'll find a sheet entitled Curricula Criteria, in which I've listed the 5 basic ingredients of the quantitative nature in the various curricula. The number of years devoted to it is listed in the second column, and then an example of a 120-unit program in a 4-year institution is listed. And the ECPD uses this phraseology of years because many schools have 128 units, they're on the quarter system, some of them are on 5 years, some are on the co-op basis, so that some sort of a universal measurement has to be used, and the ECPD has hit upon this year basis. So for the example I've chosen, this is for a 120-unit program that leads to a baccalaureate degree at the end of 4 years. We would require then that the school have 15 units of mathematics beyond trigonometry, Did it have 15 units of basic sciences, physics, chemistry, biology in some cases, and the earth sciences in others? It would require that there be 30 units of engineering sciences and 15 units of other engineering subjects that would tend to integrate these engineering sciences into a meaningful whole. And then, in addition, there would be 15 units of socio-humanistic studies, totaling 90 of the 120 units. Now, that means that the school must show or demonstrate that it requires at least 90 units in these five areas. What it does with the other 30 units is up to it to determine, and it will only affect the accreditation through the qualitative criteria. On that same sheet, I've indicated some of the elements that the IEEE would like to see in an accreditable electrical engineering program. Now, the IEEE may not have requirements that are in conflict with those of the ECPD, and they do not. The IEEE would like to see in an accreditable program some exposure to circuit analysis, systems theory, including some work on control systems, some work on electronics and electronic phenomena. They'd like to see something on the interaction of electric and magnetic fields on materials. They would like to see some work on information processing. They'd like to see some in-depth laboratory experience. And they would like to see some attention paid to the design process. Now, the IEEE does not make any specific recommendations. They simply ask their visitors to be on the lookout for these elements and to ask questions and be satisfied as to their inclusion in the program. If, for example, a school does not include work in electronics, then the visitor should ask why not, and on the basis of the answer that is given, make some judgments as to whether this program meets the minimum standards of the profession, as well as meets the IEEE standards as well. Now, the quantitative criteria are not as sharply defined as one would expect for quantitative. These have to do with the curriculum its flavor itself. It has to do with the faculty qualifications and the standards and quality of instruction and the fashion in which the whole thing is put together. It also deals somewhat with whether or not the scholastic work of the students is about the same as it is elsewhere in the country. And it has to do with the general ambience, if you please, surrounding the whole academic enterprise. In the qualitative criteria, one is developing a series of impressions, and this is why it's necessary to have a site visit to the school. One cannot get this information from reading a report. Much of the quantitative information you can, but on the other hand, very often a school will deviate from some of the quantitative criteria, and some judgments have to be made as to whether the deviation is one that meets the minimum standards of the profession or not. And this can best be done by looking at it on the scene. When you're on the scene, the most important thing that you will be doing is evaluating the faculty that are carrying on this educational activity. After all, the faculty are the key to the educational process, no matter how you slice it. If the school does not have an adequate faculty, it cannot produce an adequate program. I don't care how good the students are, how good the facilities are, anything else. If it does not have a competent faculty, it can't carry on the educational enterprise. The question naturally is asked, what constitutes a qualified faculty? When one is looking at a faculty member, I always look at the questionnaire that's provided, the response to the questions that are asked of the faculty member having to do with his educational qualifications. That doesn't mean that every faculty member has to have a PhD by any means. But is he educationally qualified to lead the thinking of the young people that he's dealing with? Is he professionally qualified? Has he had some practice as an engineer? Has he ever earned a dollar as an engineer? And is he currently practicing as an engineer? I think a very elegant phraseology is he currently and historically qualified as an engineer? After all, we don't want people standing before engineering students who themselves are not capable of practicing engineering. Is this individual creative? Is there any evidence in the questionnaire or in the conversation that you will hold with them to indicate that this person is truly a creative individual? And creativity does not mean that he must be doing research. It's an indefinable, difficult quantity to determine, but you'll have to develop some feel for the creativity of the individuals with whom you're talking. Creativity may be manifest in research. It may also be manifest in development work of some sort, either in the school or outside the school. It may be manifest in other activities of a sociological nature. Maybe the person is one who is acting as a consultant to many governmental bodies. There are many, many ways in which creativity can be vested. I think the absence of creativity will glare at you, but the presence of it may be a little more difficult to determine. One also has to ask, is the raw material present? Is the quality of the students sufficient so that the faculty can carry on the incremental education of the students that come to it? Is it possible for them, given the student base, to turn out a person in the period of time stated who will meet the minimum standards of the profession? Are the facilities sufficient for carrying on the educational enterprise? And I don't mean, is there a large, well-equipped laboratories, because very often facilities in a Quonset hut will be better than the facilities in a very large laboratory. But one must get some feel for whether the facilities are present to carry on the education that the school says it's doing. Is there an adequate supporting staff? Does the faculty have to type its own letters, its own quizzes? Is there sufficient technical staff, technician staff, that can carry out the machine shop, the electronics work necessary to carry off this educational activity? Are the finances pertaining to the electrical engineering program adequate? And in that regard, your team chairman will have some guidelines or some ideas about the financial situation of this particular school. Is the administration of the department, the dean, the president, are they conducive to producing the kind of an atmosphere that education can develop and thrive in? These are some questions that I think you will want to keep in the fore when you're evaluating the institution. And furthermore, these should ought to appear in your report, and I'll be discussing that aspect a little later on. Also, you must keep uppermost in your mind that while you're in this school, you are no longer Mr. Jones or Mr. Smith, representing your own personal interests, your own personal ideas, with your own little axes to grind, but rather you're Mr. Jones, Mr. Smith, representing the profession and the IEEE. As in this school, you will be the profession, and the profession will be judged by your conduct. You must be thorough, you must be incisive, and you must be wise. This will be continued on the other side.
This ends side one. To continue, stop the tape, turn it over, and play side two. Thank you.